Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to a family medicine practitioner. He's actually a graduate of the University of Texas at El Paso, went away and got a doctor of osteopathy and is now a practicing medicine person. He's also got some very interesting ideas about applying new techniques, well, very old techniques, but afresh to the practice of family medicine. His name is Ralph Holdsworth. And Ralph, welcome back to Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
It's great to see you. Mm-hmm. I almost didn't recognize you unless you told me that we'd met many, many years ago in an inorganic chemistry class. Let's, before we get into this sort of idea that you have about taking old Japanese methodologies for medicine and applying them today, let's find out, how did you get into this game of medicine, and then in particular your research interest in medicine?
Well, I think the first interest there in some of the research was that, you know, developed here at UTEP, University of Texas, El Paso, where I had a hard science curriculum, and I was actually one of your students in inorganic chemistry. And I took that love and the passion of hard sciences and then was able to carry that on and implement those tools when I actually became a medical doctor physician. Early on, I had a number of opportunities to go abroad. I went to Europe and studied with a Mucus Pharmaceutical, a German pharmaceutical, which actually used enzymes as therapeutic modalities for inflammation and a number of other medical situations, and just have continued to apply my hard sciences to the biological science, and specifically in the applied science of medicine.
Treating human disease with enzymes, I mean, that's not something that a lot of people know about. I mean, we tend to get a drug, mm-hmm. right? But I've never heard of anyone in my sort of sphere mm-hmm. who went to the doctor and they said, oh, take this enzyme as a prescription mm-hmm. drug. Tell us about the history of that. Mm-hmm. Who were the first people to start thinking in those mm-hmm. terms?
Some of the earliest innovations, even Galen, used enzymes. Hippocrates using poultices, et cetera, of a macerated plant, which had plant enzymes. But a large amount of my research developed out of an ancient medicinal food from Japan called natto. Over 1,000 years of what I call empirical testing and collaboration, and it's actually been a very well accepted cultural entity. One of the earliest pharmaceutical companies I collaborated with was a Japanese pharmaceutical company based upon enzymatic therapies, and still family owned, but began in 1899. So I think the cultural societal aspects and the use of enzymes are very different from our modalities here in the United States, but I've drawn significantly from their experiences.
You were mentioning that this is going back well before the 1800s, though. I mean, this has been a sort of a societal activity in the mm-hmm. Japanese society for hundreds, thousands of years?
Or? Thousands of years. And actually, Keith, it has its roots actually back with a samurai warrior where they had used boiled soybeans to feed the horses. And at one specific campaign, they were in a hurried retreat. They threw the soybeans boiled into the back of these straw baskets. Well, lo and behold, these had a microbe that inoculated the soybeans and developed this fermentation process, which later became the Japanese medicinal food called natto. This samurai warrior had noticed that his horses had a profound preference for eating these quote-unquote rotten soybeans. And there's a lot of fact and fiction, but the mythology still goes back to that these samurai warriors championed their horses' strength and endurance is based upon them eating this fermented soybean. And later in the 1980s, Dr. Hiroki Sumi isolated that active ingredients called natto kinase and found out it was actually a very tremendous, what we call a second generation fibrinolytic, where we're actually able to increase endogenous TPA and break up blood clots.
And that's the one of the uses that is out there today?
Absolutely. That's been working closely with the FDA, trying to bring it into a medical food status, since it already is what we call GRAS, generally recognized as safe, and it has been in the food supply since thousands of years, but we've isolated a very active ingredient in it that does break up blood clots.
I mean, I'm just thinking now, and I said at the beginning, I'm not thinking about enzymes, but of course, I like cheese that's aged, you know, Gorgonzola cheese or Stilton cheese. As a child, I mean, it just looked terrible. There was all these blue streaks. And I mean, is there any known medicinal value to eating older cheeses? I mean, aged cheeses?
Well, absolutely. Enzymes are able to, they're biocatalyst. And a lot of the, I go to soybeans, but most of the cultures around internationally have always used some fermentation process of various foods and have touted their medicinal aspects to them.
So I can tell my children if they don't like the smell of it or the look of it, it's going to be good for them. But of course, that will even drive them further away. No child wants to eat anything, quote unquote, because it's good for them, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So, okay, so you went to medical school and you became a family practitioner. But you've always had in the back of your mind then this application of science and the knowledge of biochemical processes to sort of help in your practice.
Absolutely.
How does that go? How does that go down with your patients who are not usually prone to going in there and talking about such distinctive types of remedy as you're talking about?
Well, it's actually worked very well. We have a certain modality or subset of patients that basically we call phase three detoxifiers. In other words, their P450 cytochromes are not able to break down traditional pharmaceutical agents. And so this subset are the ones, as you come in, they're sort of probably the creation of a lot of gray hair in physicians because they have a multitude of allergies and they have autoimmune diseases or they have a multiple subset of clinical issues and diseases. So they sort of get pushed back onto the side because they're just not straightforward. And what I've been able to do is approach them more of a systems approach where I'm looking at them integratively. We're looking at environmental issues. You know, was there a toxic exposure, Stachybotrys? Was there a nutritional deficit? You know, what's their environmental, their stress? And pulling this all together and looking at the patient, what we find out basically is that a lot of people, the only thing they have in common is the label of a disease. And then what we try to do is sort of forensically go back and, you know, peel off the onion and see how did that particular person arrive in that place and then develop therapeutic modalities to retrace them back to a pathway of health.
You're building up a clientele far beyond where you actually practice. I mean, you get people referred to you because you're rather specialized in this approach.
Well, absolutely, and it's by default. But basically what has happened is that there's a large amount of people throughout the world who have allergies or adverse drug reactions, ADRs, to conventional medications. And approximately 1 out of 4 of us has a thrombophilic state genetically. And then if you're another subset of that group,
thrombophilic, tell us what you mean.
A tendency to inadvertently form a blood clot.
Yeah.
And it's purely academic. It's life-threatening. Over 400,000 people in the United States will die. It is the silent killer. If it develops in your leg, we call it a deep vein thrombosis. If it migrates through your right heart and lodges in your lung, we call it a pulmonary emboli. And again, if it's in your heart, acute myocardial infarct or heart attack, or if it's in your brain, it's either hemorrhagic or ischemic stroke. So more people die from an inadvertent blood clot than even cancer in the United States. So where do you focus your time on this planet? I've chosen to concentrate on this area. And so to address your initial question is, so yes, I have a number of people that consult me basically because they really don't have any other alternatives from the armamentarium of conventional thrombolytic drugs or anticoagulation drugs. And we've had very good success with the nattokinase simply because it comes in through the immune system, sort of has a diplomacy, red passport, if you will, where we don't have build up a lot of autoimmune. That was one of the problems with the streptokinase. People would develop, you know, autoantibodies to it, and then that therapy was ineffective. But So what we find out about nattokinase is that it's really a biological response modifier. So it goes in well. It ends up showing where it needs to be as far as immunological, just because how it's transported through the immune system. So bottom line is it's very compatible, not only with a variety of patients of different P450 cytochrome makeups, but also it's very compatible with conventional medications as well.
Is there a genetic marker for people who are predisposed to make inadvertent blood clots?
Oh, absolutely. There's one of the factor V Leiden. You have antiphospholipid syndrome.
Okay, so the bottom line, I can go and get tested tomorrow.
Absolutely.
They'll say, hey, panel, get on some soybeans or something like
right.
that. But, I mean, as you get older, you're always told, take a baby aspirin, okay, because this is something that presumably helps put away inadvertent blood clots. I mean, is that a satisfactory regimen in general?
Well, I mean,
my
research, and I think aspirin or salicylic acid has done tremendously. It works, obviously, at preventing platelets from aggregating. What we find out with nattokinase is that we prevent red blood cells from aggregating or clumping together and then forming sedimentation. It also has an antiplatelet effect, very similar to a very popular anticoagulant called Plavix. And it works through the same mechanism, the ATP mechanisms of that. But again, nattokinase's ability to upregulate the endogenous ability of our bodies to break up blood clots. So that, I think, is a distinct difference. Conventional pharmaceutical drugs, as they sort of come in and sort of heavy hand take things over, whereas nattokinase actually just upregulates the plasminogen activation system, which is a whole subset in our blood system that prevents inadvertent blood clots.
So do you take anything?
Absolutely, since 2002.
And you're a young man, so, I mean, this is relatively speaking. Right? You're a young man. And so this is something which you simply take as a preventative, not because you know you're predisposed to inadvertent blood clots or anything?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you've never actually had any analysis to show that you are more predisposed than the rest of us?
No.
But it's just something you take. That's good. Mm. Physician, heal thyself.
Yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Ralph Holdsworth. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. It came from the ice, a monster of unimagined size, and it was alive.
What are you talking about? Sounds like the plot from a B-grade horror film. You do realize we don't review movies here.
Actually, that would be neat with all the sci-fi flicks out there, but no. I'm talking about scientists who revived a 30,000-year-old virus, the biggest virus ever found.
It's comparable to a small bacterium when usually viruses are 80 to 1,000 times smaller. We're lucky it infects amoebas rather than us. That's actually what researchers used to bait the ancient virus from the Siberian permafrost.
Named Pithovirus sibiricum, this virus has a thick wall with a unique honeycomb structure that caps the opening. It's unusually hollow, with far less genetic information compared with a typical virus, which is jam-packed.
And only a third of its proteins are similar to other viruses. This isn't the first giant virus discovered. One was found in water samples from Chile in 2003, another in Australia, and in 2013, the DNA of a giant virus called Marseille virus was in the lymph node of an 11-month-old boy.
Doctors removed the inflamed lymph node, and fortunately, he recovered in a year. The same virus has also been detected in seemingly healthy blood donors, so the Marseille virus's role in disease is a bit murky.
As for the newest virus, the interesting question is whether global warming could revive other dormant viruses and pose a future threat. Even so, we'd be far more preoccupied with cities underwater than a few giant viruses.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Ralph Holdsworth, who's a practicing family physician. We're talking about inadvertent blood clotting and how to prevent that. And some of us are more predisposed to that. And there are medications, but there are also little something called a nanokinase that you can get from soybeans, fermented soybeans. And we were just saying, Ralph, that you actually take this yourself on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Where do you get it from? You just anybody can go down to the local food store and say, hey, I want some nanokinase, please?
You know, I source directly from a Japanese pharmaceutical company that does the deep tank fermentation. So these strains are very specific. They're standardized activity. And unlike the United States, Japanese has embraced enzymes as a pharmaceutical agent. So really, these are pharmaceutical grades. Yes, some of them are going into the dietary supplement market. But one of the things that I'm proposing that as for physicians, we have a medical food category, which we're able to define structure function and basically emphasize the pharmacological properties of this naturally occurring medicinal food.
So this would be somewhere along the line regulated by the FDA. Food supplements are notorious for not being regulated by anybody. They can make all sorts of outrageous claims of content and activity, and none of it's proven at all.
Yep.
So this is why you're sort of trying to formulate this third category of pharmaceutically useful foods.
Absolutely. And this category was developed under the Orphan Drug Act, I believe it was 1989, and it recognized that there were some incurable diseases there and that there was a void there that needed to be fulfilled. One thing we see is nanokinase is the only oral form of a fibrinolytic or a blood clot busting type medicine. I cover the ER. If I have someone with an inadvertent blood clot in their brain, a stroke, if I meet the right criteria, then I can push a recombinant TPA into their blood vessels and sometimes successfully reverse that ischemia in the brain or heart, etc. And nanokinase can be taken preventatively as well as therapeutically.
So when you take this nanokinase, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking that I fly a lot, and I always get pains in one of my legs and a little bit of swelling, but it's always on the wrong side, so I'm told by my physician. He said it's okay to have pain on the outside of your leg, but if it's inside in the thigh, then you worry. I haven't got it to that stage yet. But I'm thinking, hey, should I take this nanokinase as a prophylactic? Should everybody be taking it? There must be some deleterious effect. Can it have bad impact?
Well, that's an excellent question. We've done over $1 million of acute toxicity. We never were able to reach an LD50, i.e. lethal dose.
I wasn't thinking of dying from it.
Yeah.
I was thinking of something more chronic.
Oh, yeah. No. What we found out is you can take huge amounts of the nanokinase. And specifically, to address your question, we supported a study with British Airways, in which we had passengers going from New York to London. We call that, it was a long-haul study. Dr. Belcaro out of Italy performed that. I supplied the nanokinase. The theory or the hypothesis was that could we inadvertently prevent these blood clots that you're concerned about with these passengers? And we had approximately 100 and some odd in both a controlled and then a treatment group. And lo and behold, in our therapeutic group, we had no incidence of a deep vein thrombosis.
Well, hang on. Wait a minute. You said you had a study of 100, right? So
yes.
Out of a regular 100 people going across the Atlantic, some finite number of that 100 are going to get a deep vein thrombosis?
Absolutely. In the placebo group, there was 3.
This is evidenced by what? Just the pain?
Oh, no. There was ultrasound that was used both at New York and then another ultrasound study, lower extremity Doppler, when they arrived in London.
But what did they know? Had they got some discomfort? I mean, I'm getting worried about my flying habits. Did they have some symptom that the people who came up and said they were positive out of the placebo group, did they have some inkling that they had a problem?
No, not at all. And again, that goes back to my initial, you know, 400,000 people will have an inadvertent blood clot.
And
it is literally the silent killer. one of the interests, some of the Japanese airlines are actually using natto.
Just as a food.
As a prophylactically,
right.
But yeah.
Within the, instead of the peanuts, you
exactly.
get a fermented soybean.
Yeah, exactly. If you fly JL,
right.
You will get these packets of natto, this fermented soybean nuggets. They're quite delicious. And I think some of that may be actually in the spirit of preventing right. an inadvertent blood clot. So,
any problem with taking it along with aspirin?
Well, that's an excellent question. It is compatible with aspirin. I have seen some epitaxis or nosebleeds at altitude.
You mean people taking both regimen?
Right. So basically what I've done is just pulled them back on the aspirin. And the only reason the aspirin is that approximately 30% of people will build up a tolerance to aspirin.
Yeah. And how would you know?
You don't, unless you do some fairly sophisticated, not your typical send-out laboratory for
right.
a medical lab. So,
And presumably then with the nanokinase, since it's a naturally occurring, as you say, with the red passport that just mm-hmm. goes into the system, there's no concept of building up an immunity to its function.
No, I knock on wood. I've actually had patients with soybean allergies, I mean anaphylactic shock, and they've been able to tolerate the nattokinase without any properties because we've isolated the active ingredient.
Right.
And if you brew beer, we've separated the yeast or hops from the beer. So,
right, yeah.
you know, you don't have a problem with those.
So that must have been a rather nervous first person that had anaphylactic shock for soybeans. And then you say, but I've got this little purified enzyme from the bean. Don't worry.
Well, I mean, again,
volunteers.
I've been to the facility, and it was done in a hospital setting, so
right.
I would have been able to control that with.
Well, this is fascinating, and we're going to talk afterwards, you and mm-hmm. I, and you're going to put me on something because I know that I'm predisposed a little to, and I fly an awful lot, mm-hmm. and sooner or later, maybe I need to get onto nanokinase. Let's change topics a little bit because, you know, you've clearly got I don't know if this is the right word, but a holistic approach to being a physician. And, of course, you have this DO, the Doctor of Osteopathy, as opposed mm-hmm. to the other degree that you can get to practice medicine, which is the MD degree. Mm-hmm. Your training is a DO. Would you have gone the same route if you'd gone through the regular mm-hmm. MD mm-hmm. program?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. And actually, it's sort of, did you pick the profession or did the profession pick you? And I really did have an opportunity to become an MD, but I thought that if I was going to hold true to my values, and then I felt that, you know, I should stay faithful. And the Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine has allowed me to look at things holistically. I will say that, again, the initials behind your name don't dictate how you think. But I think there was a philosophical and a cultural shift there that I wanted to be influenced by.
But there is a difference in the training. I mean, at least I presume mm-hmm. In fact, I know there is. There's mm-hmm. a difference in the training between the two degrees. Mm-hmm. But the end result is you're a doctor and you treat patients and you cure patients.
Exactly.
But I'm just thinking, mm-hmm. for our audience, it's worth spending a few minutes just to outline the difference, mm-hmm. as you perceive it, of the training mm-hmm. that you get as a DO, as an MD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, didactically, you know, our courses in biochemistry, biology, those were very similar. I think where we had augment or add a little bit more to the program was that A.T. Stills, the founder of osteopathic medicine, was an MD, but he was very adroit at studying anatomy, probably one of the big observation skill sets that I think that's losing, that we may be losing perspective because now we're depending so much on other interventional radiology, ultrasounds, MRIs, PET scans, etc. But what he was able to believe that there was a relationship between the inside and the outside and just observing patients that you would be able to discern whether they had a visceral somatic or somatic to somatic or vice versa.
I'm not sure we would understand what you just meant.
Well, basically, there would be, if there was a disease process happening in the internal organs, that would be a visceral aspect, then it would manifest itself or reflect itself onto the outside musculoskeletal frame. We don't think about this a lot, but a lot of times people will have an acute pancreatitis or even a heart attack, and they'll refer the pain back to a shoulder blade, either a right or left shoulder blade. That's one example that we usually are familiar with as lay people as to some of the early signs or symptoms of a severe medical problem. You know, a lot of the things I'm able to do, I can't tell you how many times I've been covering an ER, and the acute MI or heart attack was actually a rib out of place.
Hey.
Now, I go that pathway. I rule out a heart attack, but, you know, I'm also glad that I can do a manipulation and put that rib back in. And I've seen that with, you know, asthmatics, attacks, et cetera. So it's just another tool in my toolbox that I found invaluable in the clinic, you know, staff in ER, or when I'm even an inpatient hospitalist.
Let's finish off by looking into the future a little bit. And okay, so you import this particular nanokinase by the kilogram, right? Or has that sort of spawned some little minor industrial activity of your part? Because, you know, other people will want to get involved with this in a distributive system. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of your career and your activity.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the whole reason that I chose basically the industry there, I wanted to develop some research and development. And so that what I'm concentrating now is on specific drug delivery systems where we'll be able to take this very active ingredient and put it into a medical food modality and standardize it. And my hope is that this will be recognized and integrated much as we do other drugs, because right now there is a void, and any physician, practicing physician, will tell you that there is an extreme need for an oral thrombolytic that's safe and effective. I think nanokinase, even though it's a medicinal food, it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it is a drug. That's what I've been very foremost and transparent with the FDA. But my effort is that we get this into mainstream and provide patients and the medical community with a broader ability to treat, you know, coagulopathies or these blood clots.
But why do you need it in a different form than you already have it, in a sense? Mm-hmm. I mean, you say you've got kilograms and you take a dose every, every day, orally or whatever. Mm-hmm. Why not just have it in that particular form?
Well, there's an issue of standardizing it. So physicians and patients know they're going to get a certain activity that's able to have a certain blood clot busting capacity, if you will. And then there is an issue of timing. Right now, we have to dose this every 6 to 8 hours. What I'd like to do is do once a day dosing.
So a time release capsule or pad or something.
Exactly.
Because, so how do you take it yourself?
Well, I take it orally. I usually put it in some type of a lipophilic or oil matrix, because we now know there's also a lymphatic absorption as well as through the GALT or gut associated lymphoid tissue.
Okay, so you mix it in with some creamy... You fry your eggs and have the fat and the material at the same time.
Well, we have to be a little bit more sophisticated. We use ubiquinol, which is a tremendous, antioxidant.
Anyway, Ralph Holdsworth, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. It's great to see you again, it wasn't totally clear that we knew each other until we said who we were.
Yeah.
Thanks, Norma Martinez, for putting this together again, and thank you, the listener, for listening. That's what you do. And we talk and you listen, and that's great. Thank you very much, and bye-bye.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Mentis Neuro Rehabilitation broke ground recently on what will be a facility with more beds and more rehab amenities. The new facility, located at 4360 Donovan, features a third wing of 8 private suites, a therapy gym, garden walkways, and a wood shop. Mentis is a residential rehab provider to people with brain injuries and neurological challenges. Read more at mcasynapse.org.